Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. The United Nations Sustainable Development Goals in 2015 called for an end to female genital mutilation, or FGM, by the year 2030 under Goal 5 on gender equality. The SDGs target 5.3 aims to eliminate all harmful practices such as child, early and forced marriage, and female genital mutilation. The UN estimates that globally at least 200 million girls and women alive today have undergone some form of FGM. Girls as young as 14 and even younger represent 44 million of those who have been cut. On the show today, we'll discuss FGM, a practice also referred to as female circumcision or female genital cutting. Joining us via phone from New York City is Noncali Maksoud. She's a senior advisor on harmful practices with UNICEF. Noncali, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And also joining us is Jessica Newworth. And Jessica is also joining us from New York. She is founder of Donor Direct Action, an organization dedicated to strengthening women's rights organizations around the world by increasing access to funds, advocacy, and visibility. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Ladies, it's a pleasure to have you with us today to discuss such a sensitive topic, FGM, female genital cutting, female circumcision, female genital mutilation, different ways for different people. But let me start with you, Noncali. Talk to us about, if you will, the United Nations approach to female genital mutilation in terms of the decision to calling it even FGM, because some people refer to it differently. Why for the UN is it female genital mutilation?
Okay, thank you very much. For us, and certainly within the context of the UN, this was determined by member states. So we had a UN resolution, which a number of member states, meaning a number of countries throughout the world, a majority of those who sit within the UN, who said we cannot refer to this as cutting, but actually as mutilation. It is a human rights abuse. It does lead to significant impact on young girls in terms of their capacity to be able to give birth, their capacity to have a healthy life, to be able to be economically productive as they go forward. It is a human rights abuse, and it is a form of mutilation for many of these young girls, 44 million of which are under the age of 14.
Mm-hmm. And Jessica, let me have your thoughts on this practice. When you hear FGM, what comes to your mind?
Well, I have to say, when I first heard of FGM, maybe about 25 years ago, and I was working with an incredible advocate, Efua Dorkanu, who was the first person to bring this issue to the UN, and she called it FGM. And many women at that time in Africa who were in different countries working on this issue told me that they felt strongly that they wanted to use the word mutilation because they wanted to raise awareness about what it actually is, and that cutting was somehow a sanitizing of the practice. So at the beginning, before some of this debate about language came up, I think EFWA and other African activists had brought this term to the UN, and that's the history of that term. And I think so much of what we need to do to stop this practice and so many other harmful practices is to raise awareness. People need to know that there's a harmful medical impact of the practice. And I think over the last 25 years, it's been very heartening to see that as communities become more and more aware of the negative and harmful aspects of the practice, and also developing alternatives like rites of passage that don't involve any kind of cutting or mutilation, I think we're seeing great, great progress.
And we are definitely going to go in depth into this in terms of even alternative and the practice itself. Nakali, talk to us about the prevalence as of today. FGM has been on the agenda of activists for many, many years, even if it has gained momentum perhaps the last last decade or so. What is the prevalence today in terms of where people still practice FGM?
All right. Thank you so much. I think you did a great introduction to this interview. We have today, 200 million girls and women who have been who have undergone female genital mutilation. We know that if we don't accelerate the response that is in place, another 68 million will be affected by 2013. Having said that, the good news is that there has been a decline of the practice over the last three decades. So all the work that has gone in by the different partners being led through governments is working, and we are seeing a reduction in terms of the prevalence rate. So we came from a place where in 30 countries, ones where we actually have data, we were at one in three, and today we're talking about, one in two. So we have significant reduction. But then there are some countries where either it has stagnated or we have the risk of the rates going up again. I want to particularly highlight West and Central Africa. Because of the population demographic, we know we have a risk with increasing number of young people and young girls specifically. And if we don't have an accelerated approach, these numbers will go down. So we will go up. So we've done well so far, but if we don't accelerate, if we don't maintain our leg on the accelerator, the numbers will come up again.
Now, I've talked to women over the years who have been who have undergone the practice. There are women who say, most of the women, I must admit, many women say this practice has to end. And I think that's the general consensus. But you still find that this one woman, okay, and that's just an image, this one woman will say, I have undergone the practice and I am fighting for people to leave the practice alone. This is our culture. This is how my ancestors have undergone the rites of passage among girls. And I've gone through it. I'm not talking about me, but I'm just saying, I'm speaking on behalf of this advocate who is pro-FGM. What do you say to that woman that has undergone the practice and says, don't touch my culture? What do you say to her, Nakali?
I mean, I think that's an excellent question. And if you look at the survey data now, I think there's been an evolution in terms of the response. So today, we have many of those women who you're referring to. We have not only women, but even men, based on surveys, who say that we don't think this is a practice that should carry on anymore. So the challenge is, why do we have a majority of our community saying that the practice should not go on, and yet the practice is still going on?
Exactly.
That, for me, is our challenge between now and 2030, to find what are those drivers. Last year, we went to Sudan, and we were meeting with a population from southern Sudan, just to share a quick example with you, discussing with the community members. In South Sudan, they don't practice female genital mutilation. However, when they crossed the border into Sudan, they began to adopt this practice. And the question was, why? Talking to those mothers, they said, for them, it's a part of assimilation. It's a part of fitting within a new community and feeling like they belong within that kind of community. So for us, the challenge is not only to address FGM within the countries that we're working in, but look at it across borders, look at it across communities. There's a lot more work that needs to be done. But the good news that I take away from all of this is that, at least in terms of the response, we're at a point where people agree that this practice should not go on anymore. Now, how we get them to actually stop the practice is our challenge going forward.
And Jessica, your organization, Donor Direct Action, among many different things that you do, is to support and fund the fight against FGM, at least different organizations that are at the forefront in fighting this. Talk to us about how you implement your work. How does this process work in through your organization?
Sure, thank you. I mean, our view of how we can most quickly stop this practice is by getting support to the front lines where women and women's organizations are working in their countries, in their communities, in their villages to raise awareness and help stop this practice. And through our groups, we have four groups that we support. One is in Sierra Leone, one is in Kenya, one is in Burkina Faso, and one is in Somalia. Just in the last year, I have to say, and from two of the groups, we heard about cases where girls died from FGM, just bleeding to death. So I think this is something that actually is not only creating long-term medical and other forms of harm, we don't have any idea statistically how many girls die every year from this practice, but it may be just an enormous number. So there's a certain urgency that we feel to it. And what we try to do through our website, donordirectaction.org, and the FGM fund that we set up is to let people anywhere in the world connect with these four groups, really learn about what they're doing, and then make a contribution that goes directly to support their work. 90% of everything donated goes directly to those groups, and people can pick the countries, you know, the leaders in those countries that they want to connect with. And that's the idea. And what we're finding, what we have to remember is a little bit of money goes a long way. So much money on this issue over the decades has been spent at higher levels of policymaking and meetings, and not enough has gone, in our opinion, to the grassroots where people really are doing the hard work of getting these cultures to change by raising awareness and changing laws and implementing laws and just really moving the agenda forward.
So what is the money used for in a case like this when you're fighting a cultural practice? You send money. What do they do with the money? How is it dispersed?
Our funding is to support them. It's general operating funds, so they can determine in their country how they want to use it. But, for example, in Kenya, Tesoro Natomok Initiative has a shelter, so they would use the money for girls who are running away from this practice to protect girls, whereas in Somalia, the Galkayo Education Center for Peace and Development has a school, and their approach is to try to educate girls. And it's a very broad-based curriculum, but it includes a component on FGM. And so different groups that we support have different approaches, and they use the funds however they think it will be the most effective.
It's really important what you're saying in terms of how the fund is being dispersed, because the approach to fighting this practice is multifaceted. So what one group can do might not be really working for another group. So yeah, that's a little bit why I wanted to really understand how they are dispersing the funds on the ground. So Noncali, coming back to you, and Jessica mentioned money, how the fund is being dispersed, and economic is a big issue in FGM, because some of the cutters are there, have been doing it for a long time, and it is their livelihood. The old women, the young women, whoever they are, whether they are the grandmother or they are just the community's cutter, but in many cases, it is their livelihood. So how do you change that? How do you tell this cutter, okay, we want you to stop this practice, something she's been doing for 30-plus years. What does she do now to survive?
Thank you very much. Yeah. I mean, you're raising an excellent point. Last year, I had the opportunity to travel to Kenya, and we met with some of these women who, as you say, have been practicing for the past, 20 to 30 years of their life, and it's a source for resources for their life. It deals with their livelihoods. This program was specifically being implemented through World Vision in Kenya, and it was an excellent opportunity to talk to these ladies to find out what the drivers are, and it's not just themselves who have been practicing, but it's something which has passed from their culture. So their great grandmothers, their grandmothers, their mums. The culture is passing on. It's something that is being handed on, over the years. What we did, or what World Vision did very well in this particular situation, is to be able to provide these women with alternatives in terms of economic programs. So they were being taught, for example, animal husbandry, or basically would go through an assessment within their community to look at what other opportunities they are. And for a number of the women, they actually stopped. They won't stop immediately. I don't think we should fool ourselves. Beyond economics, as I said, it's something that they've been doing for years. It's something that has been passed on for years from their grandmother. So they also have a profile within the community as people who are held at high regard mm-hmm. for carrying out, you know, for being holders of a particular culture and tradition. So it's also something that we needed to be able to work and get over. But combined, working within the community, not just targeting the women themselves, but dealing with it as a community, looking at who the influencers are, the traditional leaders, the religious leaders, you work yourself, even with the young girls as well, to a point where the whole community says that this practice cannot go on by itself anymore within this community. And the communities have public declarations and alternatives are explored for the different cadres to be able to stop the practice. So, yes, there's something that we can do for these women, but it's not to be done for the women themselves, but to look at the community in its entirety.
Okay, and we'll definitely talk more about communities when we come back. We have to take a short break for the news, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on FGM with Nankali Maksud and Jessica Newworth. Don't go away, we'll be right back. It's time for the news with Bonsa Tufa.
Thank you, Lenore. Monday, February 4th marked World Cancer Day. The World Health Organization is calling for accelerated action to eliminate cervical cancer, a preventable disease that kills more than 300,000 women every year. Most of the deaths happen in third world countries. The WHO says cervical cancer can be cured if the infection is diagnosed and treated at an early stage. But as with some ailments in life, prevention is the best cure. In the case of cervical cancer, an effective vaccine is available that can prevent the disease when given to girls between 9 and 14 years old. Cervical cancer is a leading cause of death for women worldwide. 9 in 10 deaths occur in poor and middle-income countries. The disease is caused by a virus transmitted through sexual contact. This year marks the beginning of a 3-year campaign titled I Am and I Will, which calls for people to make a personal commitment to combating cancer. The World Health Organization just issued new cancer pain control guidelines aimed at ending the suffering experienced by millions of people. The WHO reports there are more than 18 million new cases every year and over 9 million deaths. Most cases occur in lower middle-income countries. Great advances have been made in the treatment of cancer, but measures to relieve the pain experienced by patients lag behind. The WHO hopes to remedy this with its new guidance on pain management. The WHO says opioid painkillers like oral morphine are an essential treatment for moderate to severe cancer pain. These painkillers should be given only by trained healthcare providers, and oral preparation should be given whenever possible to prevent addiction. 6 months after the outbreak of Ebola was declared in the Democratic Republic of Congo's North Kivu province, the World Health Organization is expressing cautious optimism that it's making headway in controlling the spread of the deadly virus. Latest figures reported by the WHO shows over 750 cases of Ebola and over 450 deaths. The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machadiso Moeti, says progress in containing the spread of the virus is due to a number of public health measures. Measures including the training of health workers on infection prevention and control, closer engagement with communities, case investigation, and contact tracing. In addition, the use of a vaccine and promising new drugs have been a boon to these efforts. Moeti says the risk of the virus spreading to countries like Uganda, Rwanda, and South Sudan is very high because of the heavy cross-border traffic among the countries. However, surveillance and preparedness activities have been enhanced on both sides of the border. And that's a wrap-up of your latest health news.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late, tonight we are discussing female genital cutting or female genital mutilation, as it is referred to internationally. And our guest, Nankali Maksud, Senior Advisor on Harmful Practices with the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF, and Jessica Newworth. She's founder of Donor Direct Action, an organization dedicated to strengthening women's rights organization around the world by increasing access to funds, advocacy, and visibility. Jessica, let me come to you. Your organization have been working on the topic of FGM for several years now. What type of impact have you been able to witness through the organizations that you cater to?
Well, you know, we see impact all the time. I think immediate impact can be literally the prevention of this practice, and that can change the course of a girl's life or even save her life. In some cases, when girls have undergone the practice and they may be bleeding heavily and they need medical support, that's another way in which the groups that we work with might actually save a life. The more long-term strategy is to really end the practice. And I think over the course of time, we've seen, you know, in some countries, Burkina Faso and Kenya, the statistics have gone down enormously. And I think it's because these groups are working on the ground, you know, in some cases with local authorities or national authorities, traditional community leaders, to try to raise awareness and elicit their support and leadership to end this practice. And so I think what we're seeing is an evolution of the culture where the laws are coming into place and the laws are protecting girls who run away. There's also an educational component. And as you mentioned, you know, working with women who are doing the practice to try to find alternative income generating. So I think in every single case, when we look at what these groups are doing, we see both immediate and long-term impact. I think people who want to support this practice, there's no better way that they will get more impact for their money than to get money into the hands of these groups that really are working on a shoestring and yet doing so much already.
Okay. And Nankali, before the break, you talked about a community's involvement, which is such an important aspect of this awareness and really trying to curb this practice around the world. Yeah. Now, a lot of times, there is this sense that FGM is associated to a religious practice. Yet you talk to religious leaders, whether they're Muslim or Christian or other, they will tell you it's not a religious practice, it's not in the Quran, it's not in the Bible. So this sense of FGM being a religious practice, how do you address that? How do you work with religious leaders to really shed a light on the fact that it is a misconception, misunderstanding?
You know, thank you so much. In a big part of our work, and I mean, listening to Jessica, I am in complete agreement that for us to be able to eliminate FGM, a big starting point, a place where we really need to scale up, is working with community organizations. And in doing that, one of the key things that we do is to identify who the influencers are at community. Who is it that is saying that this practice must continue? Why are they saying that? And how can we work with them to be able to stop the mutilation from taking place? And as you've highlighted, we find that, you know, a number of religious leaders are at the front line, are influencers of the practice. As I said, for us, one of our key components is working at community. So we're working with religious leaders. Fortunately, in the evolution of the FGM response, today we have a number of religious leaders, be they Muslims or any other religions, who are very clear that there is nothing within the religious tenets that calls for FGM. So a big part of our work is to look at who the leadership is amongst the different religions, starting with Islamic, because I think the misconception or the myth that Islamic religion sanctions FGM is still playing a big part in the response. So we're engaging with the leadership. We're looking at what the religious tenets are saying. We're convening these different religious leaders. We're meeting with them at community level to discuss, to debate, and to share good practices from other countries, from religious leaders of the same religions, and saying, if they say it's not happening here, why do you think it's happening? It should happen within your community. It is work that will take a long time. I think we've done well where we are today, but clearly a lot more needs to be done, because some people still strongly believe in this, and religion, you know, has a key influence on our lives. And so we do need to continue to work with both religious leaders and traditional leaders as well.
Now, there is this the story of this gentleman in Kimana, Kenya, Maasai, from the Maasai tribe, was championing the fight against FGM and is really being successful. There is a lot of attention that has been drawn in his community and the work he's doing. Now, someone like this, who is a man and getting involved in this issue that affects women and is making an impact, is an example of how men can also contribute to the fight. Talk to us about the role of men in this dynamic. How do you convince men to be part of the solution? How do you engage men in this? I know you talk about religious leaders in many communities, they are male. Other in many communities, they are female. It's not really gender bias. But how do you engage men specifically? Because they are the one who will seek to marry these girls if they are cut. If they are not cut, maybe there is no marriage, you know. How do you do? What do you do about that? What is the message, if you will, Nonkali?
Okay. Thank you very much. You know, there is no debate that the practice of female genital mutilation is very closely linked to gender inequality within our communities. So, part of the community work, again, is to look at who the influencers are at community level, who's making decisions. And for many, if not all our communities, it is men and boys. Mm-hmm. I was really sad to see, I think over the past couple of weeks, we saw that in Uganda, where FGM is, you know, is no longer legal, but we had young boys who captured young girls and forcefully circumcised and mutilated these young girls. So the role of men and boys remains very important, very key. Again, in a mission that I had in Kenya, we looked at the community and we looked at the influencers, these traditional leaders, these religious leaders. Most, if not all, are men. And so we're engaging with them, we're dialoguing with them, we're trying to be able to show them the impact of this mutilation on young girls. Many of them, when we had this mission in Kenya, were saying they didn't even understand exactly what happens when mutilation takes place. So even raising the awareness of what that actual practice is, engaging with them as husbands, as you know, as brothers, as fathers, to fully understand and to say, is this something that they're truly sanctioning within the community that they're in? So the dialogue has been there, it will continue, and it's something that we continuously need to be able to challenge ourselves. What I can definitely say is that when we started the response, we tended to focus a lot more on women mm-hmm. and on the young girls, but increasingly you see us engaging more and more with men and boys, recognizing the role that they play within the communities. And in Africa. Yeah.
Okay. And Jessica, I would like your reaction on the same question, because as your organization, you fight for women's rights. We cannot advance women's cause without men. It's a reality. So how do you engage men, whether it's for FGM or just women's rights in general? How do you make the case for men to get engaged?
I agree with Nonkali, and I think, you know, you can't really change culture without everybody. But men have played a very, very, and boys have played a very important role in all of the issues we work on, in terms of speaking out, trying to influence their own peers in a way that's much easier in some cases than for women. I recall in Ethiopia some years ago where a young couple got married and they celebrated on national television with placards, and the man was wearing a placard saying, "I'm so proud to be marrying a girl who's not cut." And that impacted then many other weddings. They started to do that. That's, I think, the way you change culture, because, of course, in this instance, many of the concerns that women have who are the guardians of culture is their daughter can't get married because no one will marry them unless they're cut. So I think that men have a very critical role, and we've seen very brave young men, older men. As Nonkali said, okay. I think sometimes people aren't aware of the health consequences of many of these issues of violence against women.
Okay, and Jessica, Nonkali, thank you so much for joining us. That's all the time we have today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you for listening to Health Chat. I'm your host, Lina Omudu in Washington, with producer Bonsa Tufa and Al, our engineer. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm Liz.